What the cartels quickly realized was because of our system here, the system that they've created, once a migrant child steps foot on U.S. soil or arrives at the border without a parent, they instantly become property of the United States government.
The challenge is getting other people in my life to wake up to this. I sound like a crazy conspiracy theorist just by acknowledging very basic facts of the way that our system operates and is orchestrated.
If I were to read off just the charges, and I'm not going to say it here because we're on YouTube and I don't want to get your channel demonetized about exactly what was happening to these children by the employees, by the supervisors inside these facilities.
Who are the bad actors besides the actual traffickers? Like within government, who knows what's going on and isn't doing anything about it?
You need to get your money, your wealth, and your safety out of America, right? And that doesn't mean you have to leave your wealth, right? It means you need to understand how to protect your wealth, right? And Bitcoin is the only asset that can do that.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have investigative journalist Ryan Matta. Ryan is an awesome guy. He is doing God's work. This episode's going to blow your mind. If you thought the government was corrupt, you probably haven't even scratched the surface. I won't even get into it here. You're just going to need to listen. But then we do talk at the end about how Bitcoin fixes this. It is the only answer that we have to all of the madness. I think you're going to love this episode. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Ryan here. Ryan, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast, man.
Man, Michael, so stoked to be here, man. Thanks for having me. I love what you guys are doing. And man, I'm so excited to be back on a Bitcoin. The Bitcoiners show me so much love, man. So I appreciate being here. Thanks, MP.
We love and appreciate you. Hey, so why don't you tell people who you are, a bit about you, what you do? I think probably more and more people are seeing your stuff out there, but just in case there are folks who you're new to them.
Yeah, man. So my name's Ryan Matta. I'm a documentary filmmaker, investigative journalist. 4 years ago, I was just a humble Bitcoiner, you know, putting my Bitcoin podcast together and building that. And I thought that that's pretty much what I'd be doing for the rest of my life is just promoting and sharing Bitcoin with the world. Back then, too, I was probably a shitcoiner as well. You know, we all go down that path once or twice. And then I put out a video in 2022 of Andrew Tate saying it was just a 60-minute short vertical video. Almost all, like 99% of my content was long form interviews, tutorials, how to use exchanges, how to buy, sell, trade Bitcoin. And then obviously I'm covering big stories as well in the Bitcoin world, but I put out a short video of Andrew Tate saying that Bitcoin was a better investment than a house, and YouTube labeled that as violent and dangerous content. They demonetized my channel. At the time I was spotlighting, I'm a videographer by trade. Before that, before I got into Bitcoin, I was a controls engineer, and I also started an EDM clothing line. So in the process of owning my EDM clothing line, I traveled the world with my girlfriend who was a model, and I got to train with some of the best videographers and photographers in the world. So that's where I really got my, developed my passion for videography. So then when I came back into this world, I was just doing podcasts, and a company called LFA TV was like, hey, do you want to come and work for us at a event called CPAC? And just, I was making really viral shorts at the time, so they wanted me to do their short form content at their event. Girl called off and I covered her show. They're like, hey, can you cover this 4 p.m. show? And I'm like, I don't know politics. I'm like, just talk about Trump and how much you like Trump and that'll be good. So I jumped in there and filled the spot, and they liked what I did. At 6:45, I was filming Trump speak inside the auditorium. And then I looked down at my phone and all my YouTube subscribers were like, hey, why'd you cancel our membership? And I'm like, I didn't cancel our membership. They're like, well, it's saying that YouTube did. So I looked at my email and it's saying, hey, we demonetized you. And then at 7:03, I walked out of the door. And the owner of LFA TV was like, hey, we'd like to offer you a job on our network. And I'm like, doing what? He's like, politics, just what you did today. Our audience loved you. And I was like, I think I lost all my income. I might as well not turn down income, right? Like, I want to stack more stats. So might as well take this job. And I took the job. And then first week on the channel, on their network, a whistleblower came forward and told me that our government was running this massive trafficking network. And I interviewed him for an hour. And the story was so crazy. After the show ended, I was like, hey, stick around. I want to talk to you more. And I just hit the pre-record button and went for another 2 hours. And this story was just so insane. And at the end of it, he's like, hey, you're giving me that look that everybody gives me, but like, you can come down to Texas, I can show you. And I'm like, what do you mean I can come down to Texas and you can show you? Could take me to a facility where there's kidnapped migrant children in it and it's being funded with our tax dollars. He's like, well, I can't take you into it, but we can get to the property and then security will stop us from going in. We'll get trespassed if we go any farther, but I can take you there and show you. And then if we get there early in the morning, we can stake out. And if you have a drone, we can get your drone up and you can see them moving these children. And I'm like, okay, yeah, bro, sure. I remember calling my boss at LFA TV. I'm like, hey, man, like, I'm not a journalist, right? I'm just a Bitcoin podcaster. Like, I don't know what journalists do, but I think I got a story here and we should probably go. Like, you're a network, right? You should break this story. And he's like, well, what is it? I'm like, our government's trafficking children. He's like, where? And I'm like, in Texas. He's like, how much is it going to cost? And I'm like, I don't know, like $500, $600. I'm like, how about this? I'll go down there And if there's no story, I'll pay for it. If there is a story, we'll break it on your network. He's like, no, just but it's only $500 or $600. He's like, just put your ticket down there and go see what you can do. So I booked the ticket on Friday. I was interviewing the kid on like a Wednesday. I think I was on a flight that Friday. And I got down there, and sure enough, it wasn't just one facility. So I landed in the McAllen Airport within 15 minutes of the, sorry, I flew into San Antonio. And then we drove down to McAllen. Within 15 minutes of being at the McAllen Airport, I could make it to five of these different facilities. One was a Brownsville Walmart that held 1,200 boys ages 13 to 17. Another one held girls, 600, girls 0 to 12. Another one held boys, 0 to 12, 400. The next one held girls, 200, 0 to 18. And then the smaller ones were the weird ones that actually mixed boys and girls ages 13 to 17. And that's kind of where it all got started.
Dude, that is insane. So you said in a Walmart, you said?
Yeah, so they converted the Walmarts that were just in these, like, you know, podunk towns that weren't super busy, had really a small population. What they realized was, I think when they put the Walmart in there, they planned on it becoming and developing into this massive city. Well, some of these border towns, that never happened. So these owners of these Walmarts realized, hey, if we shut down our Walmart and we have somebody that's going to lease this building from us at full price, that is actually more profitable. From what I understand, it's more profitable for the owners of that facility to lease it out to the federal government to do one of these emergency intake facilities than it would be if their Walmart was as busy as Christmas Eve every single day of the year round.
Jeez, man. Okay, so I think you've already shifted maybe the order that I want to take this, because we're talking about this now. So what is the, like, where does this all begin? Like at the border, how does the operation work? And then let's get into like who's involved in this as we kind of work through it. Yeah. Like what's the operation taking place here?
Yeah. So it's a really interesting story because of how decompartmentalized this machine had to be for each individual government organization to play a role, but only individually playing a role, they had no idea what they were doing. So it was really smart how they set this up. But to start there, you have to understand how trafficking works. So when you talk about child trafficking, there's two really dangerous parts of the journey for the child trafficker, the actual trafficker himself. The second most dangerous part is bringing the merchandise across the border. Could be drugs, it could be a child. The first most dangerous part is delivering that merchandise to a buyer in America. That's where the trafficker himself has the highest probability of actually getting arrested or caught. So what the cartels quickly realized was, because of our system here, the system that they've created, once a migrant child steps foot on U.S. soil or arrives at the border without a parent, they instantly become property of the United States government. And it's now our government's job to figure out how to get this child to his quote-unquote relative or quote-unquote sponsor. So what happens is the cartels realize, like, hey, we can just brand these child. So what you'd see over and over again, if you just search child with name tag at border, they'll see kids that'll have like a name tag, safety pin to their shirt, or they'll have permanent marker with a guy's name, an address, and a phone number written in permanent marker on their arm, or inside their backpack, there'll be a little Ziploc baggie, and it'll be in their backpack, and they'll pull it out, and they'll hand it to the border, or they'll have literally like a lanyard, like you're at a Bitcoin conference, and you got your name tag, and that's what the cartels realize is, we just have to put a name, an address, and a phone number into this kid's shirt, put it on him, and then when the Border Patrol receives that kid, his job is just to take the kid in. Okay, do you need any medical care? Do you need any clothing? Do you need any food immediately? After that, you're going to sit down with us. You're going to tell us your name, where you're from, your parents, and then do you have anybody here who's supposed to be receiving you? And all of the kids have been abused and coached to say, hey, yeah, this is my sponsor right here. And they hand them that information. And then they say, who is it? Most of the time, it's your father, your grandmother, your uncle, your cousin. But a lot of times they want to use, because they have different categories, which we'll get into in a minute. So most of the time it was a father, a mother, or a grandma or a grandpa. And that was what was basically on that name tag. So then Border Patrol would then call up an NGO and say, hey, we have a kid ready for transport. The NGO would show up, pick up the child or group of children, and then would take them from... Now at the border, you're talking about DHS, right? Border Patrol is under the DHS umbrella. The NGO is an independent contractor. They're not working for our government. They're working on behalf of our government, but they're not directly controlled by our government. And then next they take them to HHS, which is Health and Human Services. HHS was the one who's supposed to do the initial intake screening. So now HHS receives this child. They didn't see it come over the border. They didn't see what it was wearing when it arrived at the border. All they see is this child, and they open its folder, and in the folder it says, you have a sponsor. They didn't see that the sponsor's name was written on you know, the forearm of this little child in permanent marker or with a name tag. They just open the file and go, oh, wow, you know, Sally has a sponsor and his name's Michael. And it's now my job to reunify Sally with Michael. So they do what's called an initial intake screening or digging deeper questions. So they have a list of like, you know, a couple hundred questions. They kind of repeat the same question in different ways because the idea is originally under the Trump administration was we want to find out if this child is in indebted servitude, they call it. Do you owe somebody money basically for bringing you over to America? That's number one of the first signs that you're actually being trafficked by somebody. So because the system was so flawed, they started to overwhelm the system. They would do like an all-out government request for any government agency, and it's a temporary assignment. This happens in all agencies of our government. So they would take like, we need 1,000 employees to come down here and manage one of these emergency intake facilities, because they didn't want people that were trained in child trafficking. They didn't want people that were trained in children. They just wanted the system to be chaotic. So when they overwhelmed it, people would just check boxes and move these children through the system as fast as humanly possible. So they're supposed to be interviewing this child and making sure that the child's not being trafficked. But really, the system was so overwhelmed, and if they didn't process out children in 14 days, they would get seriously reprimanded. Now, you're on a temporary assignment, even though you're at an emergency intake facility and you work for, say, the FBI. At that point in time, you work for HHS. So they can technically, you could lose your pension. You could be suspended without pay. There's, you know, they have all the control over you. So once these people took these temporary assignments, the employees, they were really locked in and committed to either doing this job and doing it the way that they were told to do it, or they were going to lose their government pension. A lot of these employees had, you know, 20 years in. They were just trying to ride out this last assignment, because when you take a temporary assignment, when you go back after that 6 month or 90 day period, or 6 month or 1 year period, when you go back to your normal agency, you get to pick whatever state you want to live in, and you automatically get topped out in the GS pay scale. So you go from a GS 14 to a GS 18 or whatever it is instantly. And then you're like, oh, I want to go work in Hawaii because there's an opening in Hawaii. I can go to Hawaii and take that opening. So if they just kept their mouth shut, did their job, didn't make any waves, they would get moved on. So what we had was once they do the intake screening with the child, they would then have to try to coordinate the delivery of the child to that sponsor. So they open the kid's file, they hit up Michael and they say, hey, Michael, are you expecting a kid? And you say, yeah. They go, what's her name? Sally. Okay, what's her birthday? You know, 10-10-12. Oh, okay, great. We need you to fill out this basic job application. And it was like literally like a crappy job application. No references. Just give us your information and where you plan to take this child. And after you submit that, then they contact you via WhatsApp and they say, hey, can you send us an ID? And you said, yeah, sure. You pull out your phone and you take a photo of whatever ID you had. They were accepting birth certificates without any photo ID on them that expired 2 years ago from a third world country, and saying, well, that's all the ID he's got. Yeah, he lost it at the border. Well, okay, we'll just accept that for now. And once they verified that they run like some simple background check on that name, but they were only running background checks in America. They weren't running them through Interpol or internationally. So this person could have been a convicted sex offender in 3 different countries and escaped prison. And as long as he hadn't been charged in America, he would pass the background check here in America. About 95% of these people getting these children were these undocumented illegal immigrants. And then they would coordinate, then they would send the child to the NGO. And once they got done doing that with the interview or the basically approval or the pre-vetting of the sponsor, they would then call up the NGO and say, hey, Sally's, you know, grandpa or uncle is ready to pick him up. You're going to take this child to the San Diego, California baggage claim Monday at 2 p.m. So the guy would pick her up on Sunday night. He would travel there. He would get there. And then Monday at 2 p.m., they would come and they would meet the guy at baggage claim. And then when he's meeting the guy at baggage claim, what he had to do is he had the manila envelope where they took the WhatsApp photo and they took a screenshot of it and they sent it in there and they had that in the manila envelope. And then inside that manila, and then he would ask the person, hey, Michael, I need your ID. And he would hold up the ID and make sure that the ID matched the thing in the folder. So, Michael, you didn't have to be there. You could have put an ad on Facebook for $500 and said, hey, can somebody pick up my daughter from the airport? I just need you to stop by and grab my ID. You hand them your ID, and somebody that's black, looks nothing like you, could go to the airport, hand your ID to this person, and get this child. And that's what we saw. And that is exactly how our government lost. They took physical possession of 452,000 children, 452,121 migrant children. They delivered, according to Tom Holman, on December 14th of 2024, they had delivered 350,000 children, where after they delivered them, they do a wellness check where they try to contact the adult and the child, and they couldn't locate or contact over 350,000 of these children.
Jeez. So the process itself, obviously broken, and it's like, in terms of the lack of efficiency, it's exactly what I would expect from government. Who are the bad actors besides the actual traffickers? Like within government, are like, do they understand? I mean, to the point you made that you've got like different agencies, you got people who are temporarily filling in on these part-time assignments. Like, who knows what's going on and isn't doing anything about it within government or within these NGOs?
So in the very beginning, from like the employee level within our government, I would say probably absolutely nobody. I would say they didn't fully really understand how the operation was working until about 3 years later, 4 years later, once our film started breaking, once we started having Senate hearings on it, once whistleblowers started coming forward, pretty much everybody knew. Now at an upper level, so you have Alejandro Mayorkas, and these are all members under the Biden administration. This is what's crazy about this is like, I would think that the Trump administration would be going in guns blazing. I never thought we'd be here where we're at in America, because I thought for sure Alejandro Mayorkas, he's the one who designed the entire invasion. He was behind the CBP One app. He was behind catch and release. He was behind the open border policy. He was the one who worked with Biden to obliterate every immigration policy that Trump put into play. And that's what opened our border. So you had Alejandro Mayorkas and DHS, which basically create a public-private partnership, theoretically, with these cartel members. I mean, they literally created the system which allowed cartel members to immediately start tagging children. And if your audience doesn't believe and thinks this is crazy, number one, I got documentaries with all the receipts on it. But if they just go on YouTube and they go search cartel drops child over border wall, you'll see cartel members. I mean, those CCTV video, all the border cam videos, one after another, if cartels are at a frat party and they like you want to drop a beer down to your buddy and you lean over the balcony and get the beer as low as you can and just open your hand and the beer falls right into his hand. That's what they were doing with children, except for nobody was catching them. And we're talking about 18-foot border walls. So the girl's probably hanging down, probably 12 to 14 feet high still, these five-year-old children, and they're just smack and hit the ground. And you see the kid kind of like, oh, like slowly get up. And they would drop them specifically in areas where Trump had installed night vision. They had ground sensors. They do that specifically in areas where there's that it's heavily patrolled, because that's their merchandise, right? They want to make sure that that child is getting picked up and getting put into the system almost as quick as possible. They don't want to be eaten by a coyote, right? So the cartels would probably lurk off in the distance just to make sure that, you know, it was Border Patrol or somebody came and received that child. And they would give the child directions. When we drop you, you know, if you do get up and walk, you know, it's just a mile down that way till you hit the first station. And they would probably, it was probably the cartel's responsibility to literally trail them along the border and make sure that that merchandise actually made it to a Border Patrol agent, which it always did. And that's kind of how the system. So then you have Alejandro Mayorkas and DHS. You have Xavier Becerra, who created the HHS system. And then you had Robin Mercos from ORR, which is the Office of Refugee and Resettlement, who was specifically designed to manage all of the NGOs, all of these, I think it was 200 and, no, sorry, it was 39, yeah, it was 279 of these migrant child facilities, these facilities that were taking migrant children and supposed to provide care and comfort for these children and act like their parents until our government could figure out how to reunify them with a sponsor. I think total across the country that they could hold a capacity of 35,000 children at any given time. Now, under the Biden administration, these facilities got so bad, specifically one called Southwest Key Programs, that so many children were getting abused by the employees inside this system that Merrick Garland's DOJ had to file a lawsuit against them. It was a massive lawsuit. If I were to read off just the charges, and I'm not going to say it here because we're on YouTube and I don't want to get your channel demonetized about exactly what was happening to these children by the employees, by the supervisors inside these facilities. If I just read off the list of charges for each individual employee, we would sit here for 30 minutes just going, Sally, Johnny, and Bob, 5, 3, and a 7-year-old girl, were blah, 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 by blah, 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 and just go on to the next one, and the next one, the next one, the next one. There was so many of this. It was so common. And only 1 out of 10 cases is statistically reported. So we only know about 1 out of 10, and that list was still so long that Merrick Garland's DOJ had to file a lawsuit against Southwest Key Programs. I think it was $50 million, if I'm not mistaken, and that was designed to make these children whole, the ones that had been abused, and help right the wrong that we did. Pam Bondi's first month in office, she dropped that lawsuit, and we still have no idea why, and they gave no explanation. They said because Southwest Key Programs, their punishment was never getting children again. They weren't going to be allowed to house children ever again. And then, but a week after that, or 2 weeks after that, they sent out an email to all Southwest Key employees saying that they needed to come back to work to receive additional training. And it's like, well, why are you bringing back thousands of employees for additional training if you don't plan on opening these facilities back up? We think that they've been rebranded and reopened up under a new name. And then that is the company that they are using to now take back in these migrant children after the Trump administration goes and rescues them.
Wow. So if you were to speculate on why Pam Bondi dropped the case, I assume Merrick Garland probably started that lawsuit, the investigation, because he knew that his time was short and he wasn't going to have to see it through. Because my sense is just government's corrupt to the core. And so it's not, you know, passing of one administration to the next doesn't really earn you any progress. Why would Pam Bondi have dropped this? This feels like a slam dunk. You could certainly, only 10% are even reported. You could go do a bit of digging and figure out who's liable or some of the people who are liable.
I think because Alex Jones got hit with a $1 billion lawsuit for saying that something about Sandy Hook not happening, or, you know, the parents about Sandy Hook. The parents were so distressed because of what Alex Jones' words, the words he said, that Jones is getting a $1 billion lawsuit. What do you think the lawsuit looks like when we take possession of your child and we put them into a system where they're being abused, even though we know that countless children had been abused in that exact same facility by that exact same employee, and we allowed the employee to stay there. We continue to fund them with our tax dollars, and then we continue to put your children into that environment. And then the worst ones are the ones when we move your child from one facility it was abused in under the same company, and we move it to another one from Arizona to, say, California, and then your kid's getting abused by employees in both of them. Like, I think the lawsuits were so monumental, and this happened to so many children, that it theoretically, if the right attorneys got their hands on this, I think they would have bankrupted HHS, they'd have bankrupted our government. It would have been trillions of dollars worth of lawsuits for all these children that were abused when they were supposed to be being protected by the United States government. Our government took possession of them. So what they're doing now is it seems like they're rescuing these children and they're just trying to deport them. Not deport them, they're trying to reunify them back with their parents back in whatever country that they came from, just to get rid of the evidence. Once they get them out of the country, they're gone.
So it's sort of the Epstein list all over. Like, in the interest of national security, we're not going to do the right thing, because when you, something like that, I imagine if they investigated, if they sort of, you know, you were able to peek behind the curtains as to what was going on, the work you're doing wouldn't be so essential because everyone would know. I mean, mainstream media outlets could pick it up very easily. Like, it would be national news all over the place for weeks, and complete distrust in any government institution ever again. I would hope, but maybe not. People are pretty dumb, I suppose. Gosh, man, I don't even know where to take this. So,
well, let me add to that, right? So we had, when we first started getting on this story, it was 20,000 children missing. So within the first 60 days of the Biden administration, they had taken 20,000 children, put them into the system, and they were trying to do the wellness checks and they couldn't find the children. That kind of sparked a little outrage, but their excuse was, well, we didn't have the money to have all the staff and have these protocols in play to basically track and manage this. So then fast forward to almost like the end of 2022, beginning of 2023, the New York Times did this massive story. They'd been working on this story for like 6 months. They'd went to all these facilities. They had found these children. They had found the facilities. Tyson Packing Plant was employing children for slave labor, where one of the 14-year-old boys had his arm taken off by one of the meat packing machines. And they do that through staffing companies. So they have a big corporation, which is Tyson. Tyson uses staffing companies. The cheapest staffing companies are using children because it's so profitable. And it wasn't Tyson that was doing it. It was the staffing company that was the bad guy. We didn't know. We just hired the staffing company. Our bad. We put out a press statement. We won't let it happen again, whatever the case may be. And it just, the cycle of abuse continues. But by 2023, when Republicans took the House and they lectured us for 2 years on how they were going to use the power of the purse to rein in the out of control Biden spending and all this craziness that was going on in the Biden administration, we started having Senate hearings. So we had the New York Times reporters. It's the New York Times, right? And it's the Biden administration. So it wasn't like they were incentivized to break this story because it wasn't going to benefit the Democrats at all. And Republicans were going to use it, which they did. So they started having Senate hearings. The Republicans increased funding to every one of these NGOs after the Senate hearings, after the entire country knew what was happening. I mean, on the mainstream media, they were talking about 200,000 or 300,000 missing children, 325,000. Most of your audience has probably heard those numbers, 85,000 missing children. Those are insane numbers. I mean, the largest football stadium in America roughly is the Big House, right? It sits like 100,000 people. I mean, 350,000 children, that's an entire stadium filled to the rim three times, plus and a half, and just vanished into thin air. And our government and the Republicans increased the funding by 30 to 90% to every one of those NGOs. Nancy Pelosi only gave these NGOs $1.1 billion. Speaker Johnson and McCarthy gave them $1.7 billion after they knew this was happening.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things I'm trying to wake people up to, is the reality that you can't vote your way out of this, that neither side is good. No one can be absolved of responsibility. And it took me, I'll just admit, for a long time. Like I was like a conservative Republican, kind of grew up in not like a highly politicized home or anything, but just with those values and everything. And I will never vote again because I know it's not even the lesser of two evils. It's just like pick your evil is really what you're voting for. So, that is crazy. I don't even know where to take this. So
I can add to that because I was the most pro MAGA, like drinking the MAGA Kool-Aid, Trump's photo behind me at my studio, my wall, his autographed photo, taking my son in like sub-zero temperatures for 4 hours where we had like two hoodies on. We had my snowboard jacket, my snowboard pants. He had the full Carhartt set up on, boots, foot warmers in because it was so cold, hand warmers in our gloves. And we're out there for 4 hours, you know, filming Trump's plane fly in so we can just sit there and hear Trump speak and my son can watch Trump. Like that's how rah-rah MAGA drinking the Kool-Aid I was, thinking that we're voting our way out of this, right? Like this was our chance to save America. All we had to do was get out and vote. I am your retribution, Trump told me, right? I was at Mar-a-Lago for the release of the Police State documentary. I went down to Nashville and helped Cash kick off his foundation, the Fight with Cash Foundation, right? So I'm not just some random person. Like I was all in on this administration and I was voting our way out of it by putting Trump back in the White House and not only giving him, you know, the executive branch, we gave him the legislative and we gave him the Senate. And what have we got since we've got this man in office? Nothing. It is the same uniparty rhino swamp, and I will never be voting ever again. You couldn't pay me. If anything, I'm voting Democrat just to give them the big middle finger. But that's what the Republicans want. They don't want to have the power. They want the Democrats to be in control so that they can sit and go on Fox News every night and act like, yeah, I'm Senator Kennedy, I'm Ted Cruz, let's close the border, let's stop these Democrats. And they get into power, and they don't do anything to benefit America. It's disgusting.
So what was the moment, I'm just curious, that you went from hardcore MAGA to you were like, oh no, like this is not, you know, this I can't believe this is what I've been promoting.
So I was in, it was kind of like a succession of how that actually took place. But one of the first times, it was right before Trump had actually, he had won the election, but he hadn't got back into office. And they were talking about what we need to do to rescue all these 350,000 children. And I was in a Twitter space with Bonnie Rice. She's probably one of the world's leading experts in government-funded child trafficking, specifically with CPS and with HHS. And she says, Ryan, I'm telling you, nothing's going to change. I'm not seeing anything because if you wanted to save these children, we should have started 4 months ago putting together a special task force, right? We need the proper facilities to take these children in. We need trained staff when they get there. We need a program. We need protocols in play. And I'm not seeing it. So if I'm not seeing it, if you do at best go get the children, you're going to put them right back into the same environment that was abusing them in the first place because you haven't changed anything. And I'm just like, Bonnie, there's no way that President Trump's legacy is not going to be saving. Like, think about what a hero he is. Every day when the news sees like these kids getting saved from these horrible environments that Biden put them in, it would be a year-long, two-year-long PR nonstop campaign about what a hero Trump is for saving all these children. Every day would be a new case. There would be a new news story, new headline news about how these children were in this environment and Trump saved them. And I'm like, that's what his legacy is going to be. Because he was supposed to be this pro-saving children president. He was supposed to be the president who did the most for women and children in these type of conditions than any other president combined. I even have a Substack article like highlighting all of his accolades from his first administration on child trafficking. So that was the first part, right? And then it was watching them run out Matt Gaetz and put in Pam Bondi. And then it was me watching him pick Marco Rubio and all these just, you know, these rhino scumbags, these guys that, like, you know, he said, you know, you shouldn't lie in Ted, right? I wouldn't trust Ted Cruz to pick up my dry cleaners, I think is something Trump said. And now we got to a point where it's so bad, you see him attacking, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the most loyal, avid Trump defender. You know, Trump probably would have been in prison if it wasn't for, you know, MTG flying when her father was dying on his deathbed, or her mother was on her deathbed, had to leave her father's side to go and basically do something for Trump's impeachment, vote for Trump's impeachment, because she had to do it in person. And now watching him attack her and watching him attack Thomas Massie, and they're like, they represent what we thought MAGA was. They represent what we thought the America First agenda is. And they're the only ones speaking out against 90% of the things. Trump's solution is a 50-year mortgage, dude. Like, it's like, that's not what I voted for. So that's kind of, it's been like a succession, but like now, really like the 50-year mortgage, the attacks on MTG, they've been like the final nail in the coffin. I'm absolutely done. There's no saving America. Now MTG is resigning on January 5th of 2026. She's done. It's her last day in office. And
yeah, it's crazy. Okay. Hey, you mentioned CPS, Child Protective Services. This is your latest documentary, right? Yeah. So I started this. I got 5 minutes in and I sent a link to my brother. And I was like, dude, you need to watch this. This is the hill we die on. Like, I'm always unsurprised when I get a peek into government corruption. I mean, it's just to be expected at this point. I don't think people appreciate just how dark some of it is. Like it's like the shadow judicial system, you know, behind closed doors. Why don't you sort of frame out what the CPS scandal is that you've basically broken, and then we can kind of get into some of the details on it.
Yeah, so I think a majority of us, as I don't know if you have kids or you have, but I do, right? So I think of CPS as Child Protective Services. I think that it's there to take children away from the worst parents in the world, right? I never imagined it would be just like there would ever, maybe one in 1,000 cases or one in 1,000,000 cases, you know, a good parent makes a mistake and somehow loses their child, right? I never thought it was really designed to take children from good parents. You know, you think it's like there for the neighbor who's, you know, got this weird smoke coming out of the back of his house and it just smells like burning plastic all the time over there. And like, you know, he's wearing a dirty stained wife beater and the kid's hair is all dirty. And like, you know, he's going out and his backpack's ripped and the clothes are bad. And he just looks like the kid's distressed, right? And just doesn't look like a healthy child. He's never playing sports. He's never outside. He's always locked in the house. And he kind of smells when he goes to school, right? He's that kid. And you think that, okay, that CPS is designed to take the kids from the dad who's cooking crack, you know, in the trailer park next to, you know, so-and-so. You don't envision that it's designed to take your child. And what has happened here, started in 1997 with the ASFA Act. So that's the America's Safe Families Act. And what that did is it created a giant kitty of money at the federal level. So prior to 1997, there was no funding apparatus for each one of these states to create their own agency like CPS or DCF or DCSF. There's each state kind of has their own version of it. But when I say CPS, I just mean each one of these child protective services organizations at a state level. They're all kind of the same. So in order to get access to this big kitty of money on a federal level, it was just like COVID-19. The states had to ratify their constitution. And once they ratify their constitution and gave the federal government some power and some oversight, they can get access to this big kitty of money. And what that did is it created a quota system for each government agency that they needed to play a role. For example, when a caseworker goes to your house, she needs the cops to physically separate and take your child from you. Because most people aren't going to go like, oh, CPS caseworker, I'm not just going to hand my child over to some random woman in a dress shirt, right? But when a cop stands behind her and says, yeah, we're going to need you to hand over that child, you're more likely to hand over that child. So when a cop physically separates the child from the mother, he checks a box. Because of the system, if the sheriff's department wants to get access to, you know, that, you know, $5 million worth of capital that's been put there for them for this year, he needs to hit his quota. So what they've done is they've literally created a quota system for each government agency or each branch to kind of play their role. The cop doesn't know that he's, you know, kidnapping the child. He's just doing his job. He's just separating the child from the mother. The caseworker is just she's supposed to go into this house and she's supposed to say, is there dirty dishes? Yes, there's dirty dishes. Does the mother vaccinate? No, she doesn't vaccinate. Does the mother homeschool? Yep, she homeschools, right? Each one of these things together is considered neglecting a child. I mean, they can come in your house and there could be a pee stain on the floor because you have a brand new 2-day-old puppy that obviously nobody can control. And it just like 5 minutes before she got there, it happened to take a pee. Well, now there's a pee stain and you're a bad mother, right? There's dirty clothes on the couch. You're a bad mother. There's crayon on the wall because you weren't paying attention and you were doing the dishes and your daughter took some marker and wrote on the wall 2 seconds before the caseworker got there. All of those things, like once you open your door and you allow them into your house, they can find any reason and they will find any reason. And that's what most people need to understand is like the point that I want to make the most here is when a caseworker, CPS shows up your house, if they don't have a warrant, it's get off my property. If you do not have a warrant that you can hand me a physical warrant that says I need to let you in my house or you're taking my child, I'm not giving my child. Come back with a warrant. Get off my property now before I'm calling the cops. And that's your right. And then you have every right to do that. And most of the time, they won't be able to get that warrant if they didn't already have it in the first place. If they had the probable cause to get it, they would have got it. Okay. Now, you probably shouldn't let your kids skip school the next day or mess up anymore. So, those are kind of the things. Like in baby Cyrus's case, what they did was they took the baby to the hospital. So the baby had what's called cyclic vomiting syndrome, which means that it could only digest its mother's breast milk. But they didn't realize at the time they were trying to transition from breast milk to kind of introducing a little bit of whole foods into the baby's diet. And that's when the baby started to just have these vomitings, skits where he'd vomit 30 times a day and it would go on for 1 or 2 days. And think about that. I mean, you puke 1 or 2 times in a day, you're exhausted, let alone imagine 30 times in a day. Like, that's all day, every day, from the time the baby wakes up until the time the baby goes to bed. And you're constantly trying to keep him hydrated. You're constantly trying to get fluids into him. You're constantly trying to feed him. So that way, as he's vomiting, he's not completely getting just completely dehydrated. So they went on a bad skit one day. It was like 3 days in a row, and they were taking him to their holistic doctor and they couldn't diagnose him. So they're like, okay, let's take him to, you know, one of these bigger hospitals. And they took him to St. Luke's. And when they took him to St. Luke's, they couldn't figure it out, but they were asking the mother, oh, hey, do you do this? Do you do that? You know, does the baby eat this? Nope. Oh, I'm showing that you're behind on your vaccines. Do you want to get your kid vaccinated? Oh, no, we're not going to vaccinate our child. Oh, you're one of those parents. Well, you know, because you haven't got your child vaccinating, that's, to them, they consider that some type of neglect, even though it's your religious exemption, which they told them they're a huge Christian family, or a huge Catholic family. Their father is a pastor, so they're, or was a pastor, right? So they have all the religious exemptions that anyone would need. Not that you should have to give them to your government, but you just have to say them, and then that's good enough. And so the nurse was like, well, if that's the case, we're going to need you to go to these like wellness checks. Basically, you have to wake up and you have to take your baby in. You have to weigh your baby in the morning. You have to make sure that you're giving him Tylenol and you're giving him this. And if you miss any of that, then, well, we're basically going to call CPS on you. So she made it to the first two. And then in the third one, now the baby's been sick for 5 days. The mother's stressed out to the max. She's getting threatened to get CPS called. Then she gets sick. So she's like, okay, I'm going to call at 8 a.m. and say, hey, I'm not going to make it at 9, but I'm going to reschedule. But I'm going to take a nap. I don't feel good. And she hung up the phone, fell asleep, and woke up, you know, a couple hours later, and she had all of these missed calls, and it was all hell had broke loose. So that night, the baby was taken at gunpoint. They were ripped out of cars at a police station. The cops tapped the phone and got the geolocation data of where they were. They were at a family's house, friend's house for dinner. The family friend was actually a cop, a retired sheriff. And the cops said, yeah, you got nothing. They were moving the next day. They were going to Florida the next day. And the cops showed up and trailed them out of that house. And when they pulled out of the driveway, they saw the cop. It pulled out behind them. They knew. They called the father, like, hey. The father was a couple of cars ahead of them. They're like, hey, it's going to happen. I don't know if you've seen the cop that it was staked out of the house, but he's behind us. And he's trailing us. And they go, don't pull over till you pull into a lighted area. It's your right. You don't have to stop if they pull you over on the side of the road. You want to get somewhere where it's light and you want to get around a lot of people. And let me call Eamon Bundy. Eamon Bundy was running for governor. So he called Eamon Bundy. And Eamon Bundy's like, pull out your phone, immediately start recording. I'm on my way. Pull into the nearest gas station. So they all pulled into the nearest gas station. And as soon as they started to pull in, the cops turned on their lights. I forget the exact number, but it was like there was 21 police cars in this gas station parking lot to take the child from a family who loved them. And they were all filming. And once they realized that they were all filming, they weren't putting their phones away. That's when I think more units got called in. Next thing you know, they were surrounded by like 21 cop cars at gunpoint. They're getting ripped out of car windows, and she was holding her baby and was like, hey, like they took her to the ambulance and, basically was like, the cop's like, you got to give your baby over. And she's like, once I give my baby over, I know you're taking him. Can I just take him and go to the hospital with you? Can I just take him to the hospital? And the cop's like, no, because you either give your baby up or I'm taking him and you're going to jail. So it's, what's it going to be? And she's like, well, I can't let go. I just can't do it. And the cop's like, all right, lock her up, arrest her, take the kid. And then she hands the baby over to the caseworker. And she's like, that was it. She could have, like, there was no difference between her just handing him over. But she just, as a mother, was like, you're going to have to tell me you're taking me to prison to take my child from me. And they did. And then they end up still taking her to prison. They took the sister to prison because they mistaked her identity originally for the sister and told her that they were arresting her when they went to rip her out of the window of the car. And they got her out of the car. And she's like, what am I being arrested for? She's like, neglecting a child. She's like, whose child? They're like, your child. She's like, I don't have a child. And the cop's like, oh, that's not your baby? She's like, no. He says, well, why didn't you tell us that? And she goes, why didn't you do your job better and know who you're arresting? And it was on video, and like that clip went mega viral the next day. And then within a couple hours, they were at the next morning, they had a couple hundred people protesting. And I think it ended up getting almost to 400 people outside of the hospital protesting with signs. The father was a pastor. Eamon Bundy was running for governor at the time. And they staged this huge protest outside of the hospital. And that ended up being what put enough pressure on them to eventually get their baby back. But the story is so much crazier than that. It's all in my new documentary. If you guys swing over to X at Ryan Matta Media, it's going to be exclusively on X for the next 24 hours. Then it's going to go on to Rumble. And then it'll go on to, we're going to try over on YouTube. We'll see. All my other documentaries so far have been able to stay on YouTube, God willing. Hopefully this one will be allowed to stay up there as well. But It's very intense, and it's very important that I think every American see this. Like you said, this is the hill we die on. And know as a parent what your rights are. You want to make sure that you understand that, hey, like, even if I never have a plan to see CPS, I want to understand this information in case anything happens. If you're in a rocky relationship and you think you might be leaving your significant other and you guys have a kid together and you think he or she might be crazy enough to call CPS, you need to sit her down and you need to watch this and you need to understand that neither of you want that. You think that CPS is only going to go after your over him because he drinks something or he does this or does that. You are sadly mistaken. They are highly incentivized to hold it against you because you allowed your child to be around that man for so long. So there's so much more to this, and I just employ everybody to watch it, share it. On X, it's all about a point scorecard. So if you have time and you do come to watch it, a like's worth 1 point, a retweet's worth 2 points, a quote tweet's worth 5, a bookmark's worth 15, a comment's worth 27, and a reply to a comment's worth 151 points. So if you see it and it motivates you and you want to get involved, swing down to those comments and start replying to people. It'll really start getting thousands and thousands of more views on this film. And that's what we need. We need it to go mega viral. So I appreciate you, Michael, big time for allowing me to speak and share this information.
Yeah. Man, I can't believe you haven't been censored more than you have. So like, since you've been doing these documentaries, you've been able to mostly publish them, keep them online, like you're not getting demonetized?
On demonetized channels on YouTube. They won't let me. I didn't even put them on. I just assumed that under the Biden administration that they wouldn't let me put them up. So I uploaded all of them at pretty much within the same week to YouTube. And this was months after the launch. They weren't going viral. They were only getting a few thousand views over on YouTube. So I've never done one and plan to do the launch on a platform because I'm terrified that if I drive all the views to YouTube and this video got 500,000 views in the first 24 hours, it would have been going crazy viral. I think they would have deplatformed it. And then once they deplatform it, then you lose the 200,000 views. And then when people come and see the documentary, they go, only 50 people watch this, only 5,000 people watch this. This isn't important. I'm not going to waste my time. So I launched them specifically on X for the first 24 to 48 hours. Then I put them over on Rumble and try to get them on every other platform after that, after they've been... X is the town square. X is where, like, the politicians are paying attention. This is where all the political landscape and everything happens. So I try to focus on X first. And thank God for Elon Musk, man. Like, I know a lot of people don't like the guy and they say a lot of crazy stuff about him. But without him, we would be in chaos right now. Instagram and Facebook would have never given us the freedom. Like, I've gained like 50,000 followers on Instagram in the last 2 months. I've gained like 80 something thousand on Facebook. And I've only gained 20,000 in that period of time on X. But the previous month before that, I gained 100,000 on X. So it's hit or miss, man. It just depends on the month.
I can see a lot of places where the CPS, the operation is broken. So I think one very obvious thing, it's like you've got all of these like worker bees, like that you have law enforcement who, as far as I know, the reason CPS is here and I've got to have their back is because this is a bad parent and they're doing this evaluation. They see the pee stain on the floor, whatever little check boxes, they don't vaccinate their kids, they homeschool, whatever. I'm just doing my job kind of thing. Where it seems like further up the way though, there are people who are imposing these incentives on the CPS workers, on law enforcement. Where does that start? Where does it stop? Like, is this a federal issue? Is this a state issue? Is it just like bad policy? Like, where does this all come from?
You know, I think Reagan says it best, right? There's nothing more immortal and nothing closer to eternal life than a government agency, right? Like, once a government agency is started, it ain't going away. And it's everybody in that agency is self-serving, right? They all want to protect their own interests because if that government agency goes away, so does their job. And so does their livelihood and so does their career. So I think that at the higher up level, it's just you have this broken system that was never designed really to work. It was designed to do exactly what it's doing today. And it's just gotten worse and worse over the years. I don't fully understand that. That's a question for Diego. He's the grandfather of baby Cyrus, and he spent the last 4 years of his life. And the craziest part about this is now that hospital is suing the Rodriguez family after they got their child back because they embarrassed them, and they said a bunch of bad things or said a bunch of true things about St. Luke's. St. Luke's has now been going on a lawfare. They bankrupted the grandfather or the uncle, Eamon Bundy. They've taken over about $7 to $9 million worth of this man's wealth, completely taken everything that he owns, everything to his name. the Diego family was a little bit smarter with the way that they, he doesn't own anything, right? He has businesses or works for companies, but he doesn't have, and then in the state of Florida, by law, if you're the head of the household, they can't garnish your wages here. So they've been able to protect themselves a little bit, but it's still, they're facing $51 million worth of lawsuits. They have two warrants out for their arrest in Idaho, where this, or yeah, Idaho, where this took place. No, Idaho. Idaho, where this took place. And, it's just, it's like David versus Goliath, this story. And, you know, we've seen it, we're seeing it with Eliza Schaefer right now and Cash Patel and Sam Parker and Kyle Serafin. They're getting sued by for $5 million each by the FBI director's girlfriend for basically just being a journalist and reporting on news and information that was already on the internet. And we're in for really bad times, man. I don't think America can be saved. I honestly don't. I think weak men create hard times. You know, hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times, and good men, good times create weak men. I think we're at the point where America, we had really good times. You know, the money printer was printing money, stimulus checks were dropping, you know, everything was going up from, you know, every crap coin in the world was going through the moon. And we've got to the point where I think the hard times are about to be upon us. I think they already kind of are. I think we already know, like they're telling us that Thanksgiving turkey and dinner's down and nobody's believing it. The only thing that's really gone down is egg prices, honestly. Everything else seems to be going through the roof. Like my electricity cost was at an all-time high. Gas prices haven't dropped substantially since the Biden administration left. I mean, they keep gaslighting us and telling us that everything's getting better here in America, but it seems like everything's getting exponentially worse. And if you're watching the price of gold, the price of Bitcoin, and everything going through the roof, you're just like, hey, something's not right here. I feel like the system's about to break. Yeah, honestly, I don't think that America can be saved. I don't know how it can be saved. You said you're not voting. If we're not going to vote our way out of this, how do we get out of this? I don't really have a solution. I don't know if you do, but I'd love to hear it if you did.
Well, I mean, how do I prevent CPS from showing up to my house? I don't have a solution to that. And it's not, I mean, I know what I would do to defend my children. I don't know how we fix that and sort of a mass scale. And this maybe sort of leads to Bitcoin, and we can talk about this. I mean, I think the only thing I can control is what I can control with my family in my own personal life. And the best thing I've come up with is to opt out in every capacity of my life that I can, opt out of the broken system. And it means exchanging dirty fiat for Bitcoin, taking self-custody, ignoring the financial system, ignoring all of that noise. I've opted out of fiat health insurance in favor of crowd health. I'm buying my food locally from sources I know and trust, right? So it's like, there are a lot of little things I can do. The challenge, and this is, Ryan, this is what I love about you, is the challenge is getting other people in my life to wake up to this. Because I sound like a crazy conspiracy theorist just by acknowledging very basic facts of the way that our system operates and is orchestrated. But I think when people hear these stories, and when they're, it's like baby Cyrus, like that's one story. And you're like, oh wow, that's crazy. It's like, no. That's just a highlight that we're going to use to illustrate what's really going on. This is happening across the country on a massive scale. And it's the same thing with the border, you know, examples. They're dropping kids over 18-foot border walls all the time. And the one case that happens to make the news here or there isn't the whole story. The reason people get pissed about that is because it seems like this wild exception to the rule, when in reality, the rule is that's happening all the time. And so my hope is that when people see your documentaries and the work that you do, that they begin to put these pieces together. Hey, things aren't getting better. Hey, things are getting more expensive. Oh, lots of kids are being taken from their parents. Like, okay, I can't trust them. All I can do is defend my family in the best way possible. And more millions of people begin making the same decisions that I've begun to make over the last few years. And maybe we make progress in that way. I think you're right that the America as it exists today is unsalvageable. But I think the options are secession. Like, I think secession would be the best thing for our country.
Me too.
And then just people, and then I think Bitcoin, not because I'm not a fix the money, fix the world guy. I'm a fix the incentives, fix the world guy. And I think Bitcoin alters a lot of the incentives, and, you know, a scarce money that no one can manipulate or control, I think goes an incredibly long way in changing what government even has the ability or the power to do. So that's long-winded. I don't know if you have any comments.
Oh, I absolutely do. And that's what I love about Bitcoiners, right? Because I've been on 12 podcasts yesterday, not one Bitcoiner, not one solution. Everybody's like, yep, America's effed. We're black-pilled. I don't know what to do. And well, I'm always been the biggest advocate of, like, you need to get your money, your wealth, and your safety out of America, right? And that doesn't mean you have to leave your wealth, right? Right? It means you need to understand how to protect your wealth, right? And Bitcoin is the only asset that can do that. And like you said, your solution, I think, you know, Ayn Rand says it best, right? When the game is so rigged that no matter how you play, you lose, your only option is to choose to not play the game, okay? So we have this game, and this game is all around fiat, the fiat Ponzi world, right? All of their power comes from their ability to control that money printer. The closer you are to it, the more access you have, the better off your family is doing. But for the average person, they can't get close to that. So you need to protect your wealth. Putting it into Bitcoin, like you said, shopping at a local farmer's market, like everything you just outlined there is exactly how we fix this. And you only need, I think it's like the adoption of the internet. We already would call it hyperbolic adoption or hyper Bitcoinization. There is going to come a point where, like, if just 10% of us choose to withdraw from the system, it puts the weight of the entire system on the remaining 90%. And then if we get 20%, now that full weight of that $38 trillion in debt is sitting on the shoulders of the 80% of the population. And they're feeling that burden. Eventually, the system just breaks and it implodes on itself. And then maybe we do make the world a better place when we end up getting onto like something like a Bitcoin standard for our nation, and we get more people into it. So I think you're right. I think Bitcoin is the only answer. It's the only solution. Eric Stacks is like, man, I envy you. You put on this trench coat. You've been in the Bitcoin world. You could just stay in the Bitcoin world full time. But you put on this suit. You march back into fiat world. And you're like, guys, hey, like, we've won the war. We're over here. It's called Bitcoin. Come join us. And you do it every day. And he's like, I look up to you, man. I appreciate you. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But like, I'm getting to a point now where like, you're like, what's next? What's your next documentary? I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm to the point where I just want to go talk about Bitcoin full time and save children, because I can save them in El Salvador. And what Bukele's done down there it's truly a miracle. We're doing a fundraiser at the end of my film. So if you guys get the chance to watch to the end, we're doing this fundraiser for the House of Life. We're trying to save 8 more pregnant teenage girls that we can take off the streets in El Salvador and their babies and put them into a loving home. Nothing like these horrible environments that we have here in America. So yeah, man, I think Bitcoin is the solution, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I think it would be a very dire situation if we didn't have Bitcoin.
Oh my God, I'd be homeless. All my entire business runs on Bitcoin. Like you said, it's how do you get more people? I don't hire you as an employee to work for me if you won't accept Bitcoin. I'm not going to pay you in some fiat garbage that's going to devalue before you even get your paycheck at the end of the week, right? I want to pay you in the hardest asset known to man, and that is Bitcoin.
Yeah. And it's like we've got this life raft, and so many people, the only way they absorb any of that information is mainstream media talking about it. Is this an investment? They don't understand that there's this whole world of opportunity when you just opt out, when you say enough.
That's it, baby. That's it. It's the Bitcoin way, man. It's such a, you know, it's like I use the analogy, like our country is a Titanic. It's hit the iceberg, and all of the politicians have armed guards guarding the lifeboats. Not all of them, but enough of them for them to get on. And they're running around the ship and they're stealing the gold silverware off the table. Even though the Titanic's sinking and the politicians are telling you, don't worry, America, it's going to be fine. Bitcoin is your lifeboat and you have the opportunity to get yourself there. You have your family. You have the opportunity to get your family there. But if you choose to just trust the government, they're here to help, and you're listening to the Nancy Pelosi saying everything's going to be fine. Well, I have a feeling your family's not going to be in very good shape come two or three years from now. But if you take the time to study Bitcoin, you know, you got to put in the work, 20 hours minimum just to understand it, 120 hours to really be able to buy it, store it on a cold storage wallet. And with great reward comes great responsibility. So there's no greater gift you could give yourself or your family or your future children or your future grandchildren than don't watch this podcast. Stop it right here, right now, and go dedicate the rest. Every night you watch YouTube, you watch Netflix, stop doing that. Focus on Bitcoin, just 1 to 2 hours a night. Start with the Sailor series. Almost nobody I know ever started with the Sailor series and didn't end up buying Bitcoin. Start there, start with a few Bitcoin documentaries and realize what this asset is. Do that every night instead of watching Netflix, instead of getting on your Twitter space, study Bitcoin for a couple hours a night. And within a short period of time, you'll start buying Bitcoin. And once you do, you need to just do it consistently and relentlessly for several years. And after that long period of time, it's not even that long in the scheme of your life, only 4 years. If you just put a percentage of your paycheck into Bitcoin for 4 years, I've never met anybody who wasn't exponentially in a better position. And once you get your money right, then you start getting your health right, and then you start getting your life right, and everything starts to flow. It's like, it's very rarely you meet a Bitcoiner who's been in the game for 5 or 10 years and isn't just jacked, and much healthier because they want to take care of themselves because they fixed their money problem. And I keep talking, but I got to run here in a few minutes. So
yeah, man. No, it changes everything. No, let's, hey man, let's stay in touch. Tell people where to find your documentary, where to find you, follow you, and
I think it's so important people watch this.
Thanks, Michael. I appreciate it, man. Yeah, you can follow me at Ryan Matta Media over on X. That's where I'm the most active. On Instagram, it's Shots by Matta. On Facebook, it's Ryan Matta. On YouTube, it's Ryan Matta Films or Ryan Matta News. I've been deplatformed and demonetized so many times, I can't keep everything. Why do you have the same username? I'm like, I did at one point, you know? So it's Ryan Matta on any platform. You'll eventually find me. So I greatly appreciate you guys.
Thank you, Ryan. Take care, brother. Appreciate your time.
And that's a wrap again. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ryan. Very heavy, I know, but do some of these things that Ryan and I were talking about. Buy Bitcoin, start to take care of yourself, learn how to protect your family. And of course, go check out all of Ryan's work. He is doing an incredible job of shedding light onto the corruption of government in so many capacities. And of course, if you need help with protecting your Bitcoin, taking proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We also help with cybersecurity, privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option in Panama if you are ready to get out of whatever jurisdiction you're currently in. Again, it's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Do me a favor, if you're enjoying the show, if you like this channel, give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested. And I think that's all I have for you today. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.